of a dying cell phone, last call of a desperate man, strange sense of relief. It's our grand finale. That's The Front Bottoms. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jay's Talk Plus. This will be my last show for the season show. Ali, we'll have you covered the rest of the week with Julia Kreutz, with Nick Ashburn. And the big news yesterday, if you follow my Raptors work as well, is I got a new co-host for the Raptors show, which will start October 15th, but will also be down at Media Day on Monday. I will be alongside Matt Bonner for the season in the 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. time slot. So wrapping up Jays today, Blue Jay Central a little later tonight with Jamie and Joe and Emily and everyone. And then, Media Day Monday, we'll have a podcast out in the Raptors show feed. And then I'm off to Montreal for Raptors training camp. The offseason is about 12 hours long between the end of the Blue Jays season on Sunday and the start of Raptors Media Day. I'm excited. Excited to get to work with Matt Bonner. Wish the Jays season was extending, a little longer here. Wish they were in the playoffs. That's not how it went. They also lost yesterday, 4-1 to the Boston Red Sox. Philly beat the Cubs elsewhere to clinch the NL East. Seattle beat Houston to keep the AL West still kind of alive and to keep Seattle on the periphery of the AL wildcard race as well. San Francisco beat Arizona, which gives Atlanta a little bit more life. We're headed for a couple of days here with some unbelievably high-stakes baseball. Tampa Bay is playing Detroit this afternoon. So you have some afternoon ball before the Jays get in action. That has big implications. Kansas City's at Washington. Baltimore is at New York. New York just needs one win to lock up the American League East, or even if they got swept, just one Baltimore loss the rest of the way. Minnesota is hosting Miami. Seattle is still at Houston. And then on the NL side, Cubs are at Philly. The Mets are in Atlanta for that big series that we've talked about a bunch. San Francisco's in Arizona. San Diego's in LA against the Dodgers, with that division still up for grabs, especially if San Diego could pull off a sweep here. A lot going on. Less eventful in the Blue Jays game. They lose 4-1. We'll see. The only Jays item of note really is that Aurelvis Martinez was reinstated from the suspended list today and optioned to the complex league. As expected, as we talked about on the show with Arden yesterday, they're going to try to get him some winter ball reps and things like that. Not a factor in these last six games for the Blue Jays. Let's see how Jonah Bierenbaum's feeling about everything. He's our pal of the score at Bierenball on Twitter. He joins us now. Jonah, how we doing, buddy? Final week.
It's hard to believe, man. I'm doing well, brother. How are you?
I'm good, man. Mostly we're going to talk big picture stuff, but we did want to ask you about one item from last night's game. Alejandro Kirk picks off a runner. He also throws out a runner. He is now up to 27 base runners caught on the season. That's as many as he had the last 2 years put together. It's the fifth most in Major League Baseball, and he has the fewest stolen bases allowed of anyone in that top five. He's now up to like fourth in caught steals above average when we factor in like pitcher time and stuff like that. How are you feeling about that? We've obviously all come around on, he's a good framer. Okay, it's one knee, but like he's a reasonably good blocker. And now he's also controlling the run game well, despite not having a cannon. Are you buying on that?
Yeah, I think so. And frankly, the evolution of his profile is nothing short of utterly bewildering, because he came up as a bat first guy. We all know that. He hit at every level. He came up to the big leagues and he won a Silver Slugger Award and was an all-star. And 2 years later, we no longer talk about his offensive ability. And we talk about how he's one of the best all-around defensive catchers in baseball. He's retired almost 33% of prospective base dealers this year, which for a guy whose arm strength was generally considered to be one of the weaker elements of his defensive profile, is just absolutely astounding. Like, you really can't say enough about the work he's done to turn himself into not just a plus defensive catcher, but really, a guy who, when you put him behind the plate, he can kind of do everything. Like a guy that pitchers, have a lot of confidence throwing to, whether that's because of his ability to frame or of his newfound ability to control the running game at an almost elite level. It's really wild. Would I like to see him recapture that offensive stroke that he had earlier in his career? Absolutely. But, him turning into, maybe a league average hitter who's one of the best defensive catchers in baseball, that'll play too.
Yeah, it will. And you mentioned the arm strength there. He's he has the 15th worst arm strength among catchers. So it's not like he's, gunning guys out all of a sudden. The exchange times and pop times are like just okay. He just kind of puts it together. John Schneider attributed a lot of that to that exchange and how good Alejandro Kirk's gotten at that. But yeah, it's certainly not an arm strength thing. He's among the top 10 in Baseball Savant's catcher metrics, he has like by far the worst arm strength, the worst average throwing speed. So he's doing something right there for sure. Okay, so the question that flows from Kirk, and we've kicked it around a little bit, but we'll use this to kind of set up, you know, the look ahead to 2025. Alejandro Kirk has played 99 games this year, played 123 last year, 139 the year before, but he was not obviously starting all of those games at catchers. In fact, he's at a career high in games started behind the plate right now with 86. What is the upper limit of what that number could get to for 2025?
I think we're probably approaching it at this point. Like, you know, I don't know what effect, you know, the increased volume has on his ability either offensively or defensively. It just seems as though, you know, based on what we've seen, you know, in second halves in the past, how he's kind of tailed off, that it probably makes sense not to push him much beyond what we've seen this year. You know, when he was splitting time with Danny Jansen, I think people were comfortable with that arrangement and in that, you know, it's kind of a 1A, 1B where maybe he's catching 80 games a year and DHing the rest of the time. But I mean, the other factor to consider as well is that as his bat becomes less impactful, he kind of needs to be behind the plate to be providing value. So that's a little bit tricky as well, because he's not necessarily a guy that you want to pencil in for 60 to 80 starts at designated hitter, given how his offense has tailed off. So yeah, I mean, I think if he's playing 100 games behind the plate, that's probably the upper limit, but it's also the point at which, you know, you're comfortable with the value that you're getting defensively from him. But, you know, it's a tricky calculation, and I think it really reinforces the fact that whichever catcher they acquire this coming offseason to be his backup or complementary piece, you know, that's a guy who's going to play probably, you know, quite a bit. So it's not a roster spot that they can just sort of sleep on, because, you know, pairing up Kirk with someone, you know, who really has a complementary skill set and can be relied upon for greater volume than a typical backup catcher is really important.
Yeah, and then, you know, it's not a particularly robust catching market, because there's never been one of those. There's no such thing as it. You're talking about the Danny Jansens of the world, and then, you know, a Carson Kelly, a James McCann, that type of guy. There is not a, you know, if there were a 100-game caliber catcher out there, he would be priced out of your range, given that the Jays have a lot of holes to fill and not a ton of financial resources to do it. Obviously, they could spend big. We've done estimates of, you know, depending on what happens at ARB, maybe they have $60 million to spend, maybe they have $65 million to spend. But as we're about to go through, that has to go a long way. A second catcher is one of the things the Blue Jays need. They also need at least one of a second baseman or a third baseman. They probably need a left fielder. So there is a DH spot in there somewhere, but maybe it's cobbled together with platoons and whoever sits out the extra day. But they need at least, there's probably four spots on the position player side that you would like to address. And if you come away having addressed three of those, you're probably like, okay, we can deal with that. And then there is an entire bullpen to redo. There is, you know, look, Yariel Rodriguez and Bowden Francis have looked great down the stretch. Jake Bloss has not at AAA. Adam Macko just got back from injury. Obviously, Tiedemann, Manoah, those guys are far away. So there's stuff to address on the starting pitching side as well. There's a lot to do here. I would like to start with this, Jonah, because we've done some of the, like, how, what would you prioritize it or whatever. We're going to do it more of we're going to gamify it a little bit.
Let's do it.
And this idea comes via Dan Schulman, by the way, so credit to him for this. There are currently 33 players on the Toronto Blue Jays active roster or injured list. And we'll get into the specifics and the who and the how and the why. How many of those 33 are on the opening day 26-man roster in 2025?
By my count, I think 18 or 19.
Okay.
So realistically, they're going to be turning over more than a quarter of their active roster. And quite frankly, it could be even more than that, depending on their level of confidence in some of the incumbent relievers. Like, I think I was maybe even generous in, you know, earmarking four guys, four relief pitchers, either on their active roster currently or injured list for next year's bullpen. But the reality is you can't rebuild an entire bullpen 1 through 8 over the course of an offseason. Like, there are some guys who had either injury marred or lousy performance seasons that you're simply going to have to trust moving forwards. Yeah, by my count, it's 18 or 19, but the caveat is that this is going to be a truly transformative offseason that could could go in a number of different directions. So, yeah, hold on to your hats. But in any event, there's going to be a lot of turnover, and I foresee more than a quarter of the roster being turned over this offseason.
And I had 19. So nice. We didn't talk about this beforehand. So for anyone who doesn't, I had 19. That assumes Varsho is okay for opening day. We have heard it, you know, we won't know until January if he's going to, you know, maybe they slow play it. Who knows? But my work assumes Dalton Varsho is in there. So let's go through the position player side first. So obviously there'll be 13 position players. And I think we've got five locks only. Obviously, there will be more guys than that, but I think the locks are probably Alejandro Kirk, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., Bo Bichette, Dalton Varsho, and George Springer.
Correct. That's who I have as the position player locks as well.
Okay. That would mean there are four starting spots, a backup catcher spot, and the three bench spots. Ideally, a couple of those come via the starting spots, come via free agent or trade addition. And then there's a whole bunch of guys for like whichever spot they don't address and three bench roles. And then obviously a backup catcher somewhere in there as well. Who are you closest to putting into the lock territory, or who do you think is closest to having a role there?
I think it's Spencer Horwitz based on merit. Like, he has been nothing short of outstanding in almost 100 big league games this year. Like, the power that he's shown, I think, far exceeded anyone's expectations. And just generally, like, the quality of his plate appearances has been so high. And you look at the expected numbers, they're exactly where his actual numbers are. Like, it's not like he's, you know, gotten lucky in terms of batted ball luck. He's just really had an incredibly impressive season at the big league level, really trimmed down his strikeout rate from last year's small sample exposure in the big leagues. He's just really looked like a big league hitter. And you know, obviously the question for him is, where is his ultimate fit defensively? But I think in any event, whether he's playing second base, whether he's playing first base with Vlad at third, whether he's DHing on a regular basis, I think that Spencer Horwitz, barring a trade, of course, will be on the active roster. And then I'll add one more in there too. I think that Ernie Clement is probably going to be, at the very least, in a utility role, unless, of course, he's traded as well. I think it's almost impossible for me to envision Ernie Clement not starting on the active roster unless he's no longer in the organization.
Yeah, it's a tough one. And the trade caveat is a part of this exercise, right? It's like, okay, well, maybe, you know, a Lucas, a Loprofito, a Leo Jimenez, whatever. Now, the nice thing for the Blue Jays is that of these guys that we're going to talk about for bench spots, all of them except Leo Jimenez and Ernie Clement have options. So Alan Roden, not even on the 40-man yet, even though he certainly looked ready by the end of the AAA season. Nathan Lucas, Joey Loprofito, Addison Barger, Will Wagner, Spencer Horwitz, Davis Schneider, Aurelvis Martinez, Jonathan Clase, Stuart Baroa if he's on the 40-man still, Luis De Los Santos if he's on the 40-man still. All those guys have options. So you have flexibility there, but obviously it wouldn't make a lot of sense. Like, I don't know that there's any team out there in baseball that has carries like seven or eight position players on their 40-man at the AAA level. Those guys are not going to make the team. Obviously, you would like a couple guys there. You would love to have a catcher, an infielder, and an outfielder ready to go at that level. Guys who are, you know, taxi squad-ish readiness. But you're not gonna have all those guys at Buffalo, and you're probably not going to want to lose them to waivers. You're probably going to try to address some of your other holes via trade. So Horwitz and Clement, then, if so Ernie Clement as like a super utility guy makes sense, right? Hits lefties really well, has shown an ability to hit righties, contact profile. I mean, metrically, he's one of the best defenders in the American League this year around the infield. So that one is fairly straightforward. If Horwitz is in there for you, does that change your accounting of whether the big spend is a outfield type versus a DH type versus second or third base? Or is Horwitz, you know, is that flexible enough given he's a lefty bat, so strong side of the platoon, lots of opportunities for playing time, and he can play DH first and even in a pinch second base. Are any of these fringe decisions that we're talking about informing what you're doing in free agency, or does that have to be the flowing in the opposite direction?
It's funny because I've modeled out like four different lineups here with Horwitz playing a variety of different positions. And I think that regardless of sort of what his role is and where he's playing, I think you can still, or rather it would still be prudent and wise to acquire three bats, one to play one of the open infield positions, one to play left field, and then one to DH as well, right? You know, I don't think it's a huge deal if Spencer Horwitz were to be a primary DH, even though, you know, he's relatively young. But at the same time, you know, earmarking that role for a guy who has so little experience at the big league level, and, you know, as good as he's been this year, it's not like his max EVs pop off the chart or anything like that. That just feels like a move that could backfire. So I think, regardless of what you envision for Horwitz's role, you can still go out and get three bats. So I don't know that, you know, that question mark is going to inform what their offseason strategy should be. But yeah, I mean, I'm just looking at all the different lineups that I've penciled out, and I think it makes the most sense to go out and get three bats.
Yeah, it does. And obviously that then hampers your ability to address the bullpen via free agency, but then some of these extra guys, you know, hey, Lo Profito beats out Barger for that spot or whatever. Maybe that's a way to address. And by the way, just a note, on the platoon side split stuff, 73% of starts in Major League Baseball this year were made by right-handed pitchers. So you're talking about 3 and 4 if you are, you know, a lefty in Horwitz. Do you have a lean? Like, obviously, this is a pretty right-handed, right-handed heavy hitter market. Like, Anthony Santander is obviously switch hitter, Juan Soto, a lefty. But beyond that, it gets pretty righty heavy, including like a Ha-Sung Kim, a Willy Adames. If you spend big on an infield spot, it's probably going to be a right-handed guy. Is that of any relevance to you? Like, now that they're so lefty heavy at the bottom third of the order and the bench, like, it can't, right? You need bigger bats regardless of that context.
Yeah, I don't think they have the luxury of valuing balance, you know, and I think the value, the virtue of balance is probably overstated. Like, yes, it's good. It's good to give, you know, opposing managers, you know, something to try to game plan against and you know, to avoid, you know, sort of that statistical disadvantage of always not having the platoon advantage. But I think ultimately what matters the most is getting good hitters, you know, good hitters who can do damage. The Jays are going to finish the year in the bottom 5 in the majors in home runs, in the bottom 10 in the majors in runs per game. And we just know that, you know, if you add a Christian Walker and a Pete Alonso and an Anthony Santander to this lineup, it doesn't matter that two of those guys are right-handed and one of them's a switch hitter. Like, that just doesn't matter because they've already transformed the lineup from, you know, one of the more anemic ones in baseball to one that has tremendous home run potential. So, in a perfect world, would your distribution of righties and lefties be almost even? Sure. But what matters more is just getting good hitters.
Yeah, I will take a good right-handed hitter over a bad left-handed hitter against a right-handed pitcher, right? That's the key. And the Jays have been doing some, like we're at the end of the season. They're trying to get guys at bats and stuff like that. But, like, I don't know. You pinch hit Luis De Los Santos for Addison Barger for the platoon advantage, and it kind of highlights, it's like, yeah, wouldn't you love someone in that spot that you didn't even think about that for? But, obviously, this is the situation we're in. And, yeah, so you mentioned a couple first base / DH types there. Should I read into that you are okay with Vladimir Guerrero Jr.'s plan of Vladimir Guerrero Jr. plays a little more third base next year?
I think I'm more than okay with it. I think I was reticent in the past, but, you know, given how well he's acquitted himself at third this year after a pretty long layoff of not playing the position, and given the fact that his bat has returned to 2021 levels, you know, I'm not as concerned about, you know, his defense perhaps being a bit of a liability there. I mean, the bottom line is that, you know, I think that there's an overwhelming number of free agent bats out there who would improve this lineup who happen to be first base / DH types. And moreover, I think a guy like Christian Walker, who's, you know, a little bit older than Pete Alonso, you know, he's the kind of guy who could be acquired on a deal that doesn't require the Blue Jays to make a long-term financial commitment that they're uncomfortable with and that stretches into sort of the great abyss beyond, you know, too far into the great abyss beyond 2025. So, I just see that as probably the best pathway to improvement is with Vlad at third base. I just think it opens up so many possibilities given the talent that's available out there on the open market and given the fact that Spencer Horwitz's best position is also first base. Right. You know, I believe that there's still probably some consternation internally about his ability to play second. So I think that if he were playing first and Vlad were playing third, they're probably more comfortable with that. So the bottom line is that I think Vlad at third opens up more possibilities than Vlad being stuck at first.
Not only are they probably more comfortable with that, they have shown us that with their lineup choices, right? Like, yep. They have when those two are both playing an infield position, that's the alignment they've done. And I should say, I have been generally more pessimistic about Vlad's ability to be a good third baseman. over a large sample, just because in 2019, he was quite literally the worst defensive player in baseball by any way we can really measure it. However, tiny sample, only 100 innings this year. The metrics are like, yeah, he's been fine this year. He's been not like, he's not Matt Chapman. He's not Ernie Clement, but he's been certainly better than 2019, Vlad. Okay, so we have spent most of this time on the position player side. We picked a couple of guys who are certainly there. I think we did eight guys who are who will be back, three bench pieces and five locks among starters. Safe to say the five starters who are finishing this season in the rotation are five locks for you, whether as starters or, you know, in Yariel's case, I don't know, some hybrid kind of role if he doesn't, you know, he'll have first crack at it, but safe to say that?
Definitely, yeah. And if Yariel ends up in sort of a Ross Stripling swingman type role, I don't think that would be the worst case for him. But yeah, they're all going to be on the active roster barring injury.
Okay, and then the bullpen names. I'm going to guess that you had Romano, Green, Cabrera, Little, and Burr.
So I had, that's very good. I had four guys.
Okay.
So I had Romano, Green, Burr, Swanson. Oh, pardon me. I did have five. And then one of Little or Cabrera, not both. I see their profiles as extremely similar. Little can obviously be had at a lower cost than Yenesis Cabrera, who's going into, I believe, his final year of arbitration and generally isn't even that effective against lefties. I don't really see room for both of them. So yeah, I have five guys, but I think the big difference here is that I think that they'll bite the bullet and take another shot on Eric Swanson, given the overall body of work, given how his 2024 season was kind of beset by problems from the get-go. You know, I do think that they'll bring him back just because of the upside that he has. But it's also possible that he gets cut loose.
Yeah, and there's a reasonable case for it. We talked about it a little bit on the show earlier this week. I'm actually going to talk about it on Blue Jay Central tonight because I'm looking at relief pitcher targets. And my takeaway is like, yeah, if you were on a different team, he's the type of guy that you would be targeting. Good track record, multiple years, coming off a bad year, probably depressed the price.
100%.
Giddy up.
And it's not like, I mean, if you look at, you know, sort of under the hood, it's not like the velocity has tailed off. He's still getting, you know, really good fade on his splitter. I think it's more a function of command than anything else. And we know that relievers do this, right? They have seasons where, for one reason or another, they just can't find ways to be effective. And that's what happened to Eric Swanson this year. You know, obviously the home run rate was through the roof. But, I mean, if you squint and you look at sort of what he's done in the second half of the season, still averaging a strikeout per inning. Got the walks a little bit more under control. The home runs are a problem. Home runs have always been something of an issue for Eric Swanson, just as a function of his profile and the pitches that he throws. But I think given, you know, that track record, I do tend to believe that they're going to bring him back.
Yeah, it's an interesting case, and you lay it out pretty well there. All right, before I let you go for the season here, Jonah, the Toronto Blue Jays are not making the playoffs. Do you have a playoff team that you feel best about right now that you know, obviously everyone has some sort of injury and question mark, and there's no such thing as a good bullpen outside of Cleveland, et cetera, et cetera. If you look at the playoff field today, though, is there a team that you look at and you're like, yeah, you know what? That team's gotten here in good shape, I believe.
I think it's the Phillies. I think that the Phillies are probably the most whole of any of the postseason bound teams. Are they the team that I'm the most emotionally invested in? No, I don't think so. But, you know, they've played really good baseball all season long. Sort of, you know, top to bottom, they're really, really strong. They maybe don't have the same kind of star power as, you know, the Dodgers. But, you know, they're just a really complete team. The starting rotation is incredibly good and incredibly deep. They have a lot of thump in their lineup between Schwarber and Harper. And then the bullpen's been really good too. So, you know, there's a lot to like about this team, but are they, you know, the team that I'm pulling for? I don't think so. I still think that would be the Mets. I'm hoping that the Mets can pull this off and, you know, make some noise in October. And then also, you know, Shohei Ohtani plays for the Dodgers, and you want to see him play deep into the postseason and potentially win a World Series for the first time in his Hall of Fame career and to cap his historic, who knows, 60-60 season with a World Series ring. But if I was a betting man, I would say the Phillies right now are probably the team that I'm most confident in.
Shohei, by the way, at 53-55. Right now, great piece by Andy McCullough at The Athletic today about Shohei finally getting to do this. He's waited a long time, and obviously he's had the big World Baseball Classic moments and things like that, but yeah, this should be really exciting. Jonah, thank you for taking the time out this morning and all season.
Thanks so much, buddy. Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me along all year. And go Jags, go.
Come on, man. You had to do it. All right. Jonah Bierenbaum of The Score at Bierenball on Twitter. Let's take a break. On the other side, let's talk a little Red Sox. This Red Sox team, by the way, after that win yesterday, not entirely out of the wild card race. It's 3.5 back, but you got 5.5, 6 games left to go. I don't know. I don't think they're really in the race, but they're not dead yet. So let's talk about it. Let's talk about Brian Baio. Let's talk about Justin Slayton. Let's get into the Red Sox. We'll also talk to Chris Black for a few minutes. We'll talk about someone on the Sportsnet team who did their last series on the weekend and is hanging them up. We'll talk about all of that on the second half of Jays Talk Plus as it continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network at Sportsnet 360.
Everything you need to know about the Blue Jays, Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays keep it going against the Red Sox down at Rogers Center tonight. 7:07 start. It is the final Looney Dog night of the season, and there's some record that you guys can break by jamming more hot dogs down your gullets. I don't know the exact number, but I'm sure Shai Davidi will update you with the numbers. It'll also be the last start of the season for Bowden Francis, who has been obviously the biggest bright spot of the year for the Blue Jays, especially over this stretch of 7 consecutive quality starts. On the other side, he'll face Brian Baio, who's on a nice little run of his own over the last 6 weeks or so. Sinkers popping, ground ball rates back up, getting more swing and miss on the secondaries. Not nice to see tonight, but nice to see in general because that's an exciting young pitcher. Let's talk to Jen McCaffrey of The Athletic about this Sox team. Jen, good morning. How you doing?
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good. So the Sox are still like kind of in this, 3.5 out. Have you, I know you kind of wrote a piece this morning or last night about the missed opportunity here for the Red Sox because it is so close. Is there any thinking around the team that, hey, they could still pull this off, or 3.5 with a couple teams to jump, like the door is mostly closed here?
Yeah, it's pretty much over. You know, they shut down Kenley Jansen. They shut down Rafael Devers. They don't have Rob Refsnyder, so they're pretty much done. The only way they get in is, you know, if they, you know, all the other teams around them lose. So, yeah, it's kind of a foregone conclusion. They're done for the season, and they kind of missed an opportunity to add to the team at the deadline to, you know, bolster a young team that was surging 11 games over 500 at the All-Star break, but they didn't, and that's, you know, here they are. So
yeah, it's a tough spot, and obviously the Jays got to that situation on a different path. There was no case for them to be buyers, but I'm sure they'll look at the bottom of that wild card race and feel pretty disappointed about that missed opportunity as well. One of the things you highlighted in your piece, Jen, is that not only is it a missed opportunity to be in the playoffs, which is great on its own, but there are 6 or 7 core young players for this Red Sox team who are now not getting, you know, even a tighter race for a playoff spot. They won't get that playoff experience. How big a factor do you think that is as this team continues to build with that young core into future years?
Yeah, I mean, if your expectation or hope is to kind of, you know, get this team back into the playoffs and get, you know, back into contention in future years, wouldn't it be wise to try to give them any semblance of playoff experience, you know, for those future years? They're only going to get more. They're only going to get younger next year with, you know, their 4 of their top prospects are kind of knocking on the door, and Christian Campbell, Marcelo Meyer, Kyle Teal, Roman Anthony. So those guys are going to be added into the mix probably next year. And it would have been helpful. You know, the Red Sox obviously haven't been in the playoffs since 2021, so it would have been helpful to give guys like Baio and, you know, Tristan Casas, Jaron Duran, all these guys haven't played in the playoffs before. Wheeler, Rayu, like, yeah, giving them that kind of it's you guys know that, you know, the playoffs, it's a different atmosphere. It's a different intensity. And after playing 162, you kind of have to pick up your game, and to give guys experience in that intense environment would have been helpful. So they're obviously not going to be in that spot, and they're going to have to, you know, figure it out going forward.
Yeah, it's a tough one for sure. And, you know, you just laid out all those guys at AAA too. It's one of the best systems. And I think Baseball America had 4 of their top 25 in the latest update are from the Red Sox organization. It's a little terrifying from here in Toronto, but it speaks to that missed opportunity in Boston. Jen, we had you on in mid to late June. I think you were in Toronto at the time, and you had just sat down for a Q&A with Craig Breslow. And you and I talked about how we were still kind of figuring out what Craig Breslow's, you know, philosophy was, how he'd operate a kind of in-between year like this. We saw what they did and did not do at the deadline. Here, a couple months after that conversation, what do you think you have learned about Breslow and, you know, what his, you know, what his operating style is going to be moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're still sort of figuring it out. It was a little bit of a, you know, he did eventually pick a lane in buying for the team, but it was very much like buying on the margins and, you know, picking up, you know, they needed a right-handed bat. And you guys know Danny Jansen very well, but he's not like, you know, for a typical slugger, you know, that you, that the team needed to kind of help protect, you know, Devers and help out, you know, Tyler O'Neill, who's really the lone right-handed bat in the lineup. And so go out and get Jansen, which was a nice move. He's obviously a great player, but maybe they could have tried to get more. And then similarly with, you know, adding James Paxton, who again is a solid pitcher, but has an injury history. And then he goes out and has a, you know, calf strain, two starts into the second half and is down for the year. And then the relievers they added, you know, Sims and Lucas Sims and Luis Garcia are fine, you know, relievers, have had good careers, but, you know, not the most consistent, and there were definitely other guys on the market they could have, you know, added. And we don't know what the conversations were, of course. You know, it's hindsight 2020, so it's always easy, you know, now for me to look back and criticize it. But I think even at the time, people were kind of happy that they bought, but at the same time also, well, why not try to get guys that are slightly going to be slightly more impactful? So I think that was part of the frustration. So I think fans are probably just a little worried that that's going to continue in the offseason. Are they going to continue to try to add guys on the margins and maybe not spend, continue to not spend as much? They obviously have pulled back on spending over the past several years. When is that going to turn around? So, yeah, I think those are all questions we're still trying to figure out with how Breslow operates. And, yeah, we'll see what ends up, you know, happening in the coming months here.
Yeah, and a pretty big offseason ahead with, I think, 8 true free agents and then something like $31 million less on the books right now for next year. But obviously a couple of huge decisions, including a couple of the guys that they picked up in those trades. But the two bigger ones, Nick Pivetta and Tyler O'Neill, who are both free agents, who both have kind of curious or interesting cases in terms of how do you value them, results versus underlying stuff, or in O'Neill's case, the ability to stay healthy and things like that. And they're both guys who could potentially get the qualifying offer. Are those kind of the two headline items for you? Like, once we know how they're going to handle Pivetta and O'Neill, that'll give us an idea of what that strategy is going to look like. Those are kind of the two canaries in the coal mine, I guess.
Yeah, I think, you know, adding another right-handed bat and adding to the rotation. And then obviously, you know, they're losing Kenley Jansen as closer. You know, he's headed to free agency too this winter. So they got to figure out what they're going to be doing at closer. They have Liam Hendricks, who hasn't pitched yet this year, hasn't pitched, you know, really in a couple years, coming off of the cancer diagnosis and then, you know, the Tommy John surgery. So you don't quite know 100, you know, he's obviously got a strong resume from a few years back and throughout his career, but, you know, he hasn't pitched in a while. Are they going to hand the closer job to, you know, Justin Slayton, who's a rookie this year, the Rule 5 guy, who's had a really good year? That's another question for them. So, yeah, they kind of have a lot of holes to fill. They have a lot of, like I said, young guys coming up, but they also need to supplement those young guys with, you know, veterans around them to, you know, bolster the group. So I think all the main areas, and, you know, I didn't even mention the defense. They've had the worst defense in the league by far. It's been atrocious, and it's been a big reason why they've lost a lot of the games throughout the year. So they really, you know, having Trevor Story back at shortstop will help some, but they need to figure out how they're going to, you know, fix that, because that's, you know, been unacceptable on every level, watching, you know, routine plays just fall by the wayside on, you know, almost a nightly basis.
Yeah, it's one of the more frustrating things. And as nice as young, exciting players are, and even though they're athletic and maybe faster and stuff like that, there tends to be a bit of a learning curve on that end. So that might not, you know, the youth movement might not resolve that. Okay, so one of the things that they do know they have next year is a couple pieces of the rotation, including Brian Baio, who we'll see tonight. Obviously, a guy that people have been high on for a really long time, had a nice season last year. He was really struggling last time we talked to you and before the last time we saw him against the Jays. Last 6 weeks or so, really seems like things have clicked for him. He's settled right back down. What's changed, if anything, for him to drive these better results the last little while?
Yeah, he's made a few mechanical adjustments. He's kind of changed a couple things. But I think one of the biggest things, you know, in the beginning of the year, Andrew Bailey had a lot of his starters kind of wipe out their fastball usage and really decrease their fastball usage. And, Bayo's fastball four-seamer was, you know, crushed last year. So that's part of the reason they got rid of it. But I think it was maybe too drastic for him. And he's kind of opponents were sort of sitting on some of his other pitches. And so he started to incorporate that back into the mix, like very slightly, only about like 10 to 12% of his pitches throughout every start in early July. And it kind of started to take effect probably in early August. And really since then, that's been a big key for him to just kind of give hitters something else to think about. I think he was getting a little maybe too predictable. And things were blending together a bit and was losing command. So, yeah, he kind of tightened up a lot of things. He had gotten a big contract extension at the start of the year. And I think maybe, you know, he hasn't said that was a distraction or anything, but I can't imagine it wouldn't be. He's, you know, 24 and signed an 8-year, you know, $72 million deal. So I can imagine that's, you know, a life-changing event for anybody. So I'm sure that factored somewhat into it, even if he didn't want to admit it. So, I think combination of all those things, he kind of settled into his own, and he really has been the pitcher that they, you know, expect him to be. There's obviously even another step that he can get to, but to end his season on this note is, much better than where he was at the beginning of the year.
Last one before I let you go here, Jen. We'll see Richard Fitz tomorrow. Obviously, he's the return in the Alex Verdugo trade. He has not allowed a run yet over a couple starts. Is there a chance he could push for a rotation spot in 2025, like this, the late season audition, or just kind of fill in innings here?
No, it definitely is. There's definitely a chance. You know, they just need rotation depth. You know, obviously we saw throughout the year how many injuries they had in the rotation, you know, losing Lucas Giolito, who they signed last year, and he didn't even make it out of spring training before needing internal bracing procedure. And the same with Garrett Whitlock. They lost him too and are expecting him back. So I think the more starters you can have in the mix, the better. And they didn't have enough starters to kind of fall back on this year to kind of fill in and just give some of their young starters maybe an extra day here and there, and kind of had to keep pushing those guys. And that's why some of them burned out a little bit at certain points throughout the year. So I think there's a chance. I think the future for sure is that they want him in the rotation. But I think the smart move would be to go out and get, you know, a veteran starter that can kind of anchor this rotation. And so you don't have to put as much pressure on a guy like Bayo or Tanner Houck to be the number one. You know, those guys are great starters and off the, you know, are doing really well. But, I think they'd be well served to be kind of the number two and three guys, where if you go out and get a legitimate number one starter, then you can use a guy like Fitz, who's had a really good strong start to his career here in the first three starts, as sort of, you know, maybe a fifth guy, but more so maybe a guy that's working his way into the mix throughout the year with spot starts and kind of giving you giving some of those guys days off when they need.
Yeah, sounds like a familiar situation to the way the Jays need to build out their rotation depth here over the offseason as well. Jen, I know you got to run. Thank you so much for taking the time out. Enjoy the rest of your time in Toronto.
All right, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Jen McCaffrey of The Athletic. Make sure you're checking out all that great work. And yeah, a really good kind of big picture piece last night or this morning. I read it this morning about, you know, where the Red Sox are and the missed opportunity here, not just because they're close to a wild card spot and didn't push in a little further, but that experience factor for some of their young guys. This is the worst 3-year stretch for the Red Sox in 30 years. So that seems like the bar is low in terms of bad for them because they've had so much success over the last couple decades, but it's also a franchise that, while up until, you know, fever pitch era was joked about a lot, they have seen a lot of success. I mean, that whole city, that whole region has seen a lot of success. It's unusual for them to have had 3 years this bad in a row. Again, it's been 30 years. It's been 1992 to 1994 was the last time they were on a run like this. Also, a reminder that Sportsnet 590, The Fan, is proud to support Canadian Cancer Society, CIBC, Run for the Cure on Sunday, October 6th. At Sir Winston Churchill Park, that's 301 St. Clair Avenue West in Toronto, where registration gets underway at 8:30 a.m. This is Canada's largest single-day volunteer-led event in support of all people impacted by breast cancer. Funds raised will support world-leading breast cancer research and the compassionate support system for all who need it. For full details, visit sportsnet.ca/590 or cancer.ca. Okay. No, it's weird to pivot out of that one. Again, it's Bowden Francis, Brian Bayo. Tonight, we're going to talk to Chris Black, producer at Sportsnet, momentarily here. We'll talk about that. The only other note from last night's game while we wait for Chris here, Chris Bassett was pretty firm after the game that he would like to start game 162. It would be his turn on Sunday. He does not see, I'm paraphrasing here, but he does not see the case for him to not start that game. It's on his turn. He's healthy, etc. Gave a great quote to Arden Zwelling after the game, saying it's not fair to Ryan Yarbrough to ask him to do that as he heads into free agency. It's not fair to the bullpen to ask them to cover nine innings. I liked it. I like that Chris Bassett wants to take the ball there. I like that, and he wants to at least give him a couple innings there. Let's hear what Chris Black thinks about it. He is a producer at Sportsnet. He is at Down to Black, King of the Threads on Twitter. What's up, buddy?
Hey, how are you, Blake?
Good, man.
How was the football game last night?
Hang up on him. Hang up on. No, it was great. Like I went to the Bills Jaguars game with my brother yesterday. We're Jaguars fans, but got to do the tailgate with Jack Armstrong beforehand, and then it's always really amusing to be like the visiting fan, and everyone's chirping at first, and like I went into a gas station to get beers at one point, and like I got booed, and then by like the middle of the first quarter, everyone is just like, "Aw, honey, I hope things turn around for you." So it was not great. Okay, on the baseball side, I know you're producing Blue Jays Central these next couple games, but this past weekend was your last series of the season in the production truck. So first of all, congrats on another terrific season. But Dan and Buck had mentioned on the broadcast that it was also the last series of someone else's entire career in Tom Clark. And I know you think the world of Tom Clark, the technical director for the Blue Jays broadcast. So wanted to give you a minute here to talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, as much as, you know, for all the viewers at home, listeners at home who kind of equate, like, Buck is the face and voice of Blue Jays baseball for them over their entire lives. Tom's been around just as long, and he is as much of a legend behind the scenes for our industry as Buck is for all of those people at home. So it was really lucky. You know, I've only been doing this for a few years. It just happened to coincide that I was there for the last road series of the year, but consider myself incredibly lucky to have been around for his last series. Heard a ton of stories all weekend long. I got a chance to go golfing with him briefly this weekend. He told some awesome stories. He was in the TV truck for Dave Steeb's no-hitter. He was in the TV truck for Nolan Ryan's no-hitter. They were the only TV in town for that Nolan Ryan game. There was no home TV. So he told a very cool story, too, about that Nolan Ryan no-hitter, where the producer of that broadcast took a frame from that broadcast, turned it into a photograph, which back then wasn't as simple as it is now, sent it to the Rangers, had all the copies signed by Nolan Ryan, and then distributed that to everybody on the crew. So a very, very cool story. He's been a part of so many cool moments. So to be a part of that history way back then, and then also, you know, be in Baltimore when they clinched the division title in 2015, be around for so many. They were lucky enough to do some playoff games, including last year in Minnesota. Obviously, we all wish there would have been more. But, you know, it's just been very, very cool to be a part of it and to listen to guys like this. Like, as much as when I explain what I do to friends, to, you know, parents on sports teams, all that stuff, as much as I say, like, yeah, it's very cool and kind of intimidating at first to work with the likes of Dan and Buck and Joe and Jamie and all, and Hazel, it was also incredibly intimidating starting this job, seeing these like legends of these people have been around for years and years and years, who literally, Tom, what I could say is I've worked with them for maybe 5-6 years, never saw him get flustered one time ever. Like these guys who have been doing it for years. And I include the Mike Sparks in tape and all these other guys in tape, Troy Clare, the director, like these guys do not get flustered. Like live TV, it's the exact kind of personality you want. People who are just roll with the punches, do it with a sense of humor, do it in a professional way. So it's been an awesome pleasure to work with Tom. And it was just very, very cool over the last few days to just, again, to just by happenstance, be around for it.
Well, that's great. I'm glad you got to be a part of that. Obviously, Tom is a legend for anyone who knows what's going on behind the scenes, and hopefully Jays fans can, I mean, now that they know, and obviously Dan and Buck talked about it on air, you tweeted about it as well. Yeah, hopefully people take a moment to appreciate that. Very, very quickly, Chris, for those who don't know, he is the technical director. You're a producer when you're back there. What is the, like, elevator note difference in those two roles?
Tom does important work.
Okay.
Troy calls out which cameras to go to. The director calls out where people want to go. Tom's the guy actually pushing the buttons.
Okay.
So if we want to see a camera change, he pushes the button. If we want to see a graphic, he pushes the button. So no matter, he's the only guy that really decides where we go. I, along with Doug Walton and other producers, we might like to go to a replay, but unless Troy says go to it, and unless Tom pushes the button, we're just kind of glorified traffic cops. You know, we're just kind of there. Troy, Tom, they're really doing all the hard work.
Yeah, they got the launch codes, basically.
Exactly.
You guys are in the war room, but they got the launch codes. You're underselling, obviously, yours and Doug's role and stuff like that, but that's a fun way to frame it. Chris, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. Well, I was going to say see you at the park later, but you'll be here, dude. We're going to switch spots. I'll be down there doing Blue Jay Central. You'll be over here producing it for me.
You will hear my raspy voice in your ear later tonight.
Can't wait. Chris, thanks, buddy.
See ya.
Chris Black, a producer at Sportsnet, at Down to Black. And yeah, a lot of great stuff there on Tom Clark. Dan and Buck talked about him on the broadcast the other day as well. It's, it'll be different, I guess, to see how the whole ship operates without Tom Clark as he moves into retirement here. Okay, speaking of the end of things, this is not as final and dramatic, but this is the last Blue Jays Talk Plus of the season for me. Shoa Leo have you with Julia Kreutzer and Nick Ashburn the rest of the week. I have to do some other stuff tomorrow, and then Raptor starts up on Monday, so just transition out here. I'll be on Blue Jay Central tonight, though, talking a little bit more about some of the potential relief pitching targets for the Toronto Blue Jays in the offseason who might be affordable and maybe a little lower price than they should be based on their track record. Obviously, relief pitching is incredibly volatile. Anyway, we'll get into it on Blue Jay Central a little later. It's Bowden Francis against Brian Baio for that one. It is Dan, Buck, Arden, and Emily on the call. We got a full squad today. It's me, Jamie, and Joe for Blue Jays Central, and then Ben and Chris on the radio. This is the last Blue Jays talk of the season, so I wanted to, for me anyway, so I wanted to say thank you to all of you for listening for a third consecutive year, to all of our regular guests and our one-off guests. 2 hours solo, not possible without a really good lineup of guests pretty regularly. So thank you to Jonah Bierenbaum, Chris Black, and Jim McCaffrey today, and thank you to all of our people at Sportsnet and everyone else over the course of the season. And of course, thanks to Amit Mann, who is my producer and helps me book all of those people, gets them on the Zoom and on the phone, to Jennifer Rolnick, who is our technical director behind the glass here. So Chris just explained what Tom's role is. That's what Jennifer does for us here. And then Andrew Adams, it was Austin Mackey at one point. It's been a bunch of other people in the in that chair, Lance Kennedy, before he left us midsummer as well. So thank you to Andrew Adams today and the rest of those people. I'm going to rapid fire the leftover text in the text line from the season. Alex from Tilsonburg asks, who has the best chance of making the team next year? Horvath, Schneider, Jimenez, or Loperfido? I'm going to disagree with Jonah from earlier. I'm going to say Loperfido. They talk him up a ton. I know the results haven't been there yet. They're probably going to want some insurance for someone who can play center field behind Varsho, and he's just much further along than Class A or Baroa. So I'm going to say Loperfido. Frosty from Dartmouth, great name, Frosty, said, you don't have to throw, after the last Bowden Francis start, you don't have to throw hard if you fill up the strike zone. That matchup was a good example of it. Yeah, I mean, it's always better to throw hard, all else equal, but location rules, deception rules, Bowden Francis has seen his velocity tick down as the season's gone on, and the results tick up. There is more to pitching than just lighting up the radar gun and having the most break on your pitches. So good point by Frosty. Chris in Winnipeg says, thank you for making the mornings better this summer. Hope the Raptors do better for your coverage. Yeah, me too. We'll talk about it a lot. Obviously, the Raptors show, again, it starts on October 15th in this 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. slot. Myself and Matt Bonner, Amit, will be producing that one as well. But we'll have a podcast version out on Monday for Raptors Media Day. Yeah, hopefully they're better. Ian in Brampton had said, more impressed by Vladdy this season than I was from his MVP runner-up season. He has adjusted to the league after he adjusted to them. Yeah, it's a good point, Ian. It's fun to see this, and obviously he's doing it in a slightly different style. higher batting average, fewer home runs, but really good all-around production. I want him to get three more runs. I like round numbers. I would love for him to finish with a 300-30-100-100 season. We'll see if he can get there. We'll see if Bowden Francis can keep it rolling tonight. Thanks again to everyone all season long. This has been a lot of fun. See you down at the park a little later. Have a wonderful Tuesday.